Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking hour?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
If you're looking for the best of European football, you have come to the right Champions League place. Welcome to On the Continent. I'm Dotun Adebayo.
I'm Andy Brassel.
And I'm Miguel Delaney.
On today's Champions League extravaganza, does European football have a new world's best player? And does he have what it takes to stay at the top for as long as his predecessors? And also, what's it like to be punked by Porto? Well, ask Juventus. And Marco Rosa has already been announced as next season's Dortmund coach. Does that make him a lame duck at Borussia Mönchengladbach? Let's start with you, Miguel. Well, first of all, what's your reaction to PSG beating Barcelona so definitively? And what's the consequence of that in terms of your thinking about the changing of the guard at the very top of individual football?
Well, I do think it was maybe a confirmation night in two ways. First of all, actually, I suppose, I think Paris Saint-Germain, after what had been a bit of an indifferent season, maybe an indifferent start under Pochettino as well, announced themselves, I think, as one of the super favourites for the competition, along with Manchester City, Bayern Munich. And despite the league format, I'd actually say Liverpool, because I think just the nature of the Champions League and the nature of the season could actually reward teams who are capable of still being absolutely top class in one-off games. But of course, as we're all talking about, a confirmation night for Kylian Mbappe, and I do think he announced himself as the new best player in the world. That isn't just from this night or from what has been a kind of an uncertain start to meet domestic season himself. We really had a kind of, you know, a foreshadowing of this game in the 2018 World Cup when him and Messi were on the same pitch. And I suppose, once again, related to the quality of teams, Mbappe was on a different level. But there is a bit more to it than that. I mean, because I don't think this is just a night when Mbappe looked better than Messi. It was like he himself was going on to another level. He wasn't just this kind of super fast forward. He was a playmaker on the night as well. And you see that. This happened to Messi as well. You see that happen with these true greats in that way, where as they develop and they get, I suppose, and they fully mature, and, you know, we know all their physical attributes, they develop their all-round game as well. And that was what was so striking about Tuesday. It wasn't just a hat-trick. It was that he was running the entire game. And it, I mean, and in terms of that big question of the best in the world, what I immediately thought of when you're trying to answer it was, like, if you're looking to play one of them now, Messi or Mbappe or whatever, Mbappe just has more ways to hurt more teams. There's just more to his game at the moment, which is remarkable. I mean, you probably won't find a bigger Messi fan than me. I do think he's the best player of all time. But he's also close to 34 now, and his role has been diluted, diminished. He's had to move around the pitch to accommodate kind of waning physical attributes, whereas Mbappe is very much coming into his prime or possibly in it, and he's just devastating in so many areas.
And I think there's the sense as well that Mbappe played this game with quite a lot of economy, I thought. For someone who is, as you say, so incredibly fast, I don't think it didn't feel like he bust a gut in this game. It felt like a very, very good game from him and his best game in a while, because either side of Christmas, he's performed a little underwhelmingly, if we're being perfectly honest, certainly domestically. But this felt like him ready to impress, but not too ready to impress. I mean, it's something that, say if we talk of another great, Cristiano Ronaldo in his Manchester United career was sometimes accused of trying to take too much upon his shoulders on the big occasion. Whereas I kind of felt like Mbappe took just enough on his shoulders. I mean, when Miguel was talking before about the fact of his all-round game being something special, and of course this week with Erling Haaland having that brilliant game at Sevilla as well, and there's been a lot of talk about them sort of taking over as the top two in European football. There's been even some nascent, you know, who would you rather have in your team sort of chat, which is the precursor to 2 years down the line when everyone talks about who's the best. For me, there's not a question at the moment, even though it's a facile conversation. There's no question at the moment because Mbappe's been doing it for longer, and he has got that all-round game. He's had that all-round game for a long time. I think you look at when he just joined Paris Saint-Germain, one of his earliest Champions League nights with PSG was when they beat Bayern Munich in Paris, and it was the game that...
Yeah, facilitated, I was at that game, yeah.
Well, it facilitated Carlo Ancelotti losing his job the next day, didn't it? And Mbappe was brilliant in that without scoring. So he's always had that to his game. Now, I just wonder if, again, talking back about another sort of great, maybe not quite as great, but David Beckham always seemed as if he felt to sort of gild his greatness, he needed to succeed in the centre of midfield rather than playing wide. And I kind of wonder if this is the one little fly in the Mbappe ointment, the idea that he has to play as a fixed point centre forward to be recognised as the greatest. I don't think that really matters. I don't think you can nail him just to one place. And I think the fact that he can pop up all over the shop is one of the things that makes him so special.
I think you have a point there, though. I do think you have a point. I think the better comparison for Mbappe would be Cristiano Ronaldo in terms of the way he plays and his position as well, slightly his determination, his speed and so on. But neither Ronaldo or Messi played in the centre. So I wonder, Miguel, whether actually we overrate the players coming through the centre, whereas the real creative players or the players at the very top of their games, they're the ones that can move from the wing into the centre when it's necessary. Because what Andy said about Mbappe not breaking his stride or, you know, really giving it the full welly in this match against Barcelona, I think that is part of the winger's ability to save some, to conserve a little bit, because he knows he has to sometime move into the centre to take control of the ball.
Well, football has changed that way, and I think it's interesting there. If you look at pretty much, well, most of the top scorers, and again, particularly Messi and Ronaldo, but also players like Salah, they're no longer straight strikers in that way. And it's why Lewandowski and Kane actually are quite distinctive. Most of the scoring now comes from players arriving in the box and finishing and taking advantage of, I suppose, breaking ball in that way, because it's such a pressing game. And I suppose that ties into something we're going to talk about maybe in terms of Marco Rose and German influence. But yeah, I think the game has changed that way. Now, in saying that, Ronaldo and Messi were, I suppose, fundamentally wide players, but both came inside a lot and both also ended up playing much more central later in their careers.
It's funny, actually, Miguel, when you talk about the best forwards not being typical number nines, it was interesting hearing Edin Terzic, the Dortmund coach, talk about how he'd slightly changed the position of Erling Haaland, who is, I guess, your ultimate out-and-out striker in so many ways, even if he could develop the back-to-goal a little bit more, especially when you bear in mind his size, is the fact that Dortmund played a bit deeper and he wanted Haaland to play a bit deeper so he could basically beat Sevilla's defenders in a foot race. He could build up that momentum to go past them and to... And to create the opportunities which he got so well. Going back to Mbappe, though, fellas, I do think it's interesting because although, you know, this will, I think, live in the memories for a lot of people as some sort of crowning moment for him, that, you know, he scored a hat-trick against Barcelona at the Camp Nou and so few players have done that and it felt like a changing of the guard, et cetera, et cetera. Well, firstly, I don't think anyone who watches them regularly has seen Barcelona as a regular champions, a genuine Champions League contender for a while now. You know, they're so far off having a realistic crack at the trophy. You look how easily Paris Saint-Germain got past them without even Neymar and Di Maria. And it wasn't just down to Mbappe, because I think there are other players who deserve praise for it. I thought Leandro Paredes was excellent, for example. But it just felt that this moment was a little bit like, you know, when you used to hear pop stars in the 80s and 90s say, my mum didn't believe I'd made it till I'd been on Top of the Pops. It's almost like a way of communicating to non-football obsessives that this player has arrived, when, of course, he actually arrived a very long time ago. And this was him having a good night rather than a night that... made him into something extra, where he took an extra step up into the stratosphere or anything like that. I think as well, when you put it in that context, you look at the atmosphere in the build-up to the game when the Catalan media in particular were really had the hump about stories in France of Paris Saint-Germain's interest in Messi. And of course, this all goes back to, or most of it goes back to, when Neymar said, after the Manchester United game in the groups, come what may, I want to play with Messi next season. And there's only one place that can happen, Paris, because financially it cannot happen in Barcelona. And of course, this was something that was being worked on. It is highly hypocritical, obviously, the Catalan media talking about, you know, someone unsettling one of their players. But I think it was interesting to see in the build-up, it was almost, there were parts of the French media that were selling it to themselves, like, we know Neymar's going to stay. He's going to ink that contract in the near future. And whereas it's not so clear-cut with Mbappe, like, Paris Saint-Germain remain confident that they can sign him to a new deal after he'll only have a year left at the end of this season. But parts of the French media were selling it to themselves as, oh, well, you know, well, if Mbappe does go, we could kind of replace him with Messi. But now, Miguel, after this game, what does that look like? I mean, has this brought home the ugly truth of you would be replacing, as you say, the next best player in the world with someone who's almost 12 years older than him and who would cost about 10 times the salary?
Exactly. That's exactly it. And I was even thinking about it in relation to that big, whatever about who's the better player at this point. I was thinking about it in terms of just that investment and that race for Messi maybe at the end of the season. How's it going to look if you're a club that seeks to throw in whatever, 250 million into Messi rather than Mbappe? Because I mean, yes, okay, there might still be debate now, but just by virtue of their age, Mappe is the future. He's the one that you should be investing your money in.
Where would he end up, though? That's a big question, because if Paris Saint-Germain is where the money is...
Well, it's long been suggested that he wants Real Madrid, doesn't he, for all sorts. It's almost like Cristiano reasoning. Just Madrid have always been the allure. He's admired Ronaldo himself. And there does seem a certain... I mean, and also, this is one of those transfers that's been trailed for years. Now, I suppose the only big question is that it's the economic situation of Spanish football. And actually, I do think this should be mentioned in all this, because we shouldn't go... we shouldn't go and say what PSG are. I mean, ultimately, they're a political project. And there is still... I did find myself even watching the other night. It was impossible not to be wowed by Mbappe. But what all that's doing as well is there's an insidious nature to that, in that it's ultimately softening the view of a political project. It's making a political project more attractive and alluring. But there's also a consequence of football here. And let's look what's happening this season, right? We're having a global pandemic, as well as a global pandemic, the effects of the initial outbreak of that pandemic and a hugely congested calendar, and it's causing huge economic problems for a lot of our biggest clubs. Now, you could say on one level that this was a reckoning that was possibly needed. But the problem is, who is currently looking in the best shape? That's Manchester City and Paris Saint-Germain. Two clubs with state backing. And it's no coincidence they can come through this unscathed. And it is also relevant to the future European football in that way, in that clubs like Madrid, in this new world, who is going to be able to afford players like Mbappe if Paris Saint-Germain have so escalated? And that's something that Paris Saint-Germain targeted in that summer of 2017 when they bought both Neymar and Mbappe. One of the objectives was to drive up wages and fees so high, because they knew only a handful of clubs couldn't compete. And we could well see the consequences of that this season and this summer.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think, you know, Madrid have been saving up for Mbappe. Everyone knows that. But did it just get a lot more costly? We know, and he knows, that PSG can afford to pay him more than anyone else. And, you know, that is where they are, because they won't have to spend a transfer fee. They won't have to spend a signing on fee. And they're richer than God. And I think those three things combined. Now, he's always been very clear that he cares about the sporting element of the project. He privileges that above everything. But I do wonder if it sort of leans into a certain direction, if Real Madrid or maybe even Liverpool can't afford Mbappe this summer and he's unconvinced by the Paris project, are we saying he either re-signs or runs his contract down and it's a free in 2022? I think there are a few elements to that that have got to fall into place. Now, this signing is going to cost PSG a lot either way, because the only situation in which PSG don't have to pay Monaco extra this summer is if Mbappe doesn't re-sign but stays, because they owe Monaco another 35 million euros when A, he's sold, or B, he signs a new contract. So I think even if Mbappe were to go into the last year of his contract, obviously, there would be a great deal of brinkmanship and butterflies in the stomach if that was the case. But I don't think that necessarily means the end of it all. Now, it's interesting how the talk around Real Madrid and their next superstar target is kind of shifting to Haaland this summer. Because even if they had to purchase him pre-clause coming in 2022, that's something that would work out cheaper for them. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And funnily enough, even though you look at the physical stature of the two of them and they couldn't look more different, there's actually quite a lot of similarities to their play, even if Mbappe is a lot further down the line.
Miguel, just a quick one. We're talking very much about what it's going to cost Real Madrid. And I think Andy has made a really interesting point there to bring in Haaland, who is the other contender for world's best player of the future. Where's the best place? Where is the best place for primarily Mbappe to be, quite apart from the money? Is Real Madrid the best team for him to go to if he wants to achieve that status of world's best player in the future?
I'm actually sure, I'm not sure that's the case anymore, because I think this is going to be more of a fallow period for Spanish clubs akin to maybe the 80s or the 70s, just because of the economic direction of football and the amount of problems Madrid and Barcelona have. Now, Madrid aren't as bad as Barcelona in that regard. I think they also have, they've got what they see as sustainable plans. But if they have to save up so much for Mbappe, what does that say about the ability to put around, to put a team around him that's competitive, or one that he's carrying? Because this is, of course, what's become one of the issues of Messi, say, where he suddenly has to absolutely carry his Barcelona to a greater level than ever before, and it means that they're just not competitive. So, it's the burden of superstardom that way as well. It's not just about kind of picking the right choice, but picking the right team and making sure you're in the position to really make the best of your abilities. And it is possible that the best for all the dismissal of the French league, the best for his future could be Paris Saint-Germain, just because of the economic direction of European football, particularly after a pandemic. And also, from Paris Saint-Germain's side, you'd be thinking that they should really be throwing all their chips in here, because, I mean, whatever about Mbappe's status as a star, he's a Parisian boy who has kind of group supporting the club. There's a whole culture and, you know, status around that as well.
Avec Giroud. Oh, Sylvain, il l'a vu. Oui. Kylian Mbappé. Ouais.
Me being the veteran of OTC, I'm saying that guardedly. I'm not the old man, I'm just the veteran of OTC. Sometimes I need a little translation. So, Andy, you know, for my generation, when you say punk or punked, you're talking about an anarchist. So, Juventus were punked by Porto. Really? In which way? What does that mean?
I'm thinking more the Ashton Kutcher end of the market, although with a lot more snarling face where Sergio Conceição is involved. I mean, I don't know if it seems obvious to say that Juventus underestimated Porto a little bit, but having beaten them comfortably at this stage of the Champions League in recent memory, I think they maybe did. I know it's a second successive defeat after they lost at Napoli last weekend, but this was a very different game. You know, Juventus played a decent game against Napoli. At the end of this one, they're lucky not to be virtually out of the Champions League already. It was a really, really poor Juventus performance. Conceição himself said the only reason it wasn't a perfect performance from us is that we conceded the late goal to Federico Chiesa, which changed things in terms of the second leg. And of course, Juventus are still the favourites going into that second leg. I think it is far from a given that they go through, because firstly, it's mind-boggling to think that they could play that badly in a Champions League fixture, a game in the knockout part of the competition that they are trying to win. You know, they're still trying to win this competition. And every time Cristiano Ronaldo steps on the pitch for them, it's a reminder of where their ambitions lie. But to see Ronaldo sort of, you know, berating the referee for a penalty in stoppage time to try and salvage something from it, I mean, you think, how far have they fallen? Conceição played it very, very well. I've no doubt about that. And we'll come to what Porto did right in a minute, I think. But I think that there has to be some examination, not really of Pirlo, but of the Juventus project. Because if they go out at this stage now, which after what happened to them against Lyon last season, I don't think you can rule out at all, that would mean that, well, at the very least, they've been beaten in the last 16. You think of their last three exits, actually. If this turns out to be an exit, it would be to a Portuguese league team, a French team, and a Dutch team. For Juventus, that is so far from acceptable. When you think of the money that they've poured into this project, when you look at the wage bill, it's extraordinary, Miguel.
Yeah, something that really struck me last night, and I suppose this points to that project that you speak of, Juventus. was the clash of identities, but within Juventus and in the game they're facing. And obviously, I mean, that calamitous first goal is basically, we've seen this so many times and so many teams attempting this now. That is basically the problem that comes when you're insistent on trying to introduce a proactive possession game with a squad or a team that isn't necessarily ready yet. We've seen those mistakes so often. And of course, there's an issue then that's come up where Pirlo is basically caught between two stools, which is essentially on one side, it's a modern game that the Juve project want. On the other side, it's the actual game that suits the biggest stars they've got, including Cristiano Ronaldo, which is something much more conservative and reactive. But then in the midst of that last night, what was so ironic about it was Juventus getting done by the sort of approach that they used to be absolutely brilliant at. I mean, and not just Juventus, it was almost a vintage, classically Italian-European approach, which is almost as simple as, obviously to execute, it's not simple, but the actual basics are essentially keeping very tight at the back and not knowing when and how to hurt the opposition in attack. And it did, Pirlo probably deserves some credit, I think, because when he brought on Morata, it did change the game, and Juventus did look a much better team for the last 20 minutes. And that away goal does really change the complexion. But it also feels a little bit unfair on Porto because for 65 minutes, they've been so much better in terms of the execution of what they want.
Yeah, I guess that first goal was the ultimate definition of being punked. And you wonder whether the defensive coaches and the goalkeeping coaches of Juve have a lot to answer for. But what struck me about this and the point that you made a moment or two ago, Andy, about Cristiano Ronaldo, and it wasn't appetizing. It was, you know, quite demeaning the way that he was struggling to get that penalty. Usually in games like this, he can make a difference, but he couldn't. Porto wanted to win this, and Cristiano Ronaldo, okay, might be past his best, but he's not the game changer anymore.
No, you're right. And I think in this context, at the Dragao, where he's always got a bit of a reception, it's fair to say, as a former Sporting player, although not quite the one he got with Manchester United when he went to Benfica. This is a game where, you know, when we reach the last 16 of the Champions League and we look through these compilations of best Champions League goals and, you know, best Champions League goals by Messi and by Ronaldo, one of the ones that always pops up was that one that he scored in the quarterfinal against Porto for Manchester United, where he smashes it in from about 40, 45 yards. And you're right, at that point, there's nothing that you can do to stop Cristiano Ronaldo. Now he's very much a service-dependent player, and he has been for a very long time. Yeah. And I think that's where Miguel's Morata point comes in, that Morata is... His rubber ring in the sea, really. You know, Morata is the player
it's
who
Benzema.
Can. Yeah, exactly. Which is what he's always needed and what he's always wanted in recent years. And I think his introduction made a huge difference. But yes, I think to see him go back to Portugal and not run the show is particularly jarring, especially in a stadium where he's made so many big contributions. You know, he scored hat-tricks for the national team there in recent memory, if you go back to the Nations League as well. But look, make no mistake, Porto played this really, really well. And they've had their difficult time recently. And Sergio Conceição sort of shrugged it off in the press conference because, of course, the fact that Porto have had three successive draws in the league and Sporting have extended their lead to 10 points at the top means the title is almost certainly gone. But when he was asked in the press conference afterwards, how have you got through this tough time? He said, well, look, there are people out of work and there are people really ill out there. So I'm not going to be sitting here talking about a tough time. You know, we're paid to play football and, you know, they do have that kind of blue collar value to them, this Porto team, I think. If you look at them player for player, they are nowhere near the most talented side, Porto side, that we have seen. If you go back through Villas-Boas, Josualdo Ferreira, even, you know, not even going back as far as Jose Mourinho, you know, there have been some much more entertaining, gifted Porto sides. But this lot are really physical for a Portuguese team. They've got this never give up attitude. And, you know, they were just so much more committed to this tie and to getting something out of it than Juventus, I think.
Their second goal in the beginning of the second half actually showed that, showed determination. It was a decent goal, actually. Mikel, though, Juventus clearly have to do something in the second leg. And when they look back, on the videos of their performance, they already know that they were rubbish. But when they look back, I think they might be very embarrassed, particularly their performance in the first half. Now, if Pirlo's not to blame, what does the team then have to do to turn things around? If they hadn't gotten that one away goal, I'm not sure that they would be favourites for this on the whole. But they've got that. They've got that in the bag.
I think it was just a crucial goal in that regard. Because it doesn't just change the complexion. It changes what UEFA can do, what they need to do, and just the threshold of required to go through. And from that perspective, for all we've been kind of criticising Ronaldo here, I mean, it really isn't inconceivable. Let's remember Atletico Madrid in the same season they went out to Ajax, where suddenly it could even be not a great performance in Turin, but you get two of the right balls into Ronaldo, he scores two headers. We're having the same conversations again about his everlasting talent, about how this is, you know, this is the ultimate Champions League player. And so we really shouldn't rule that out. But also, if even as that happens, it shouldn't allow dismissal of the fact that Juventus have problems to solve. And I think one of the biggest problems is, and it's becoming a really interesting question: can Juventus play the type of football that they want in the medium term, that Pirlo is clearly there to do, with Ronaldo in the team? Sarri had the problem. And I mean, obviously, I suppose, given the scope of football history, you should always be siding with what Ronaldo can do for you rather than what Sarri can do for you. But it is suddenly a live issue. And it might feel remarkable to say that about one of the greatest players of all time, but it's true. And we saw the effect of that last night.
Andy, you wanted to talk about Conceição. He had to essentially preside over a team with big budget cuts, but he was able to bring his son into the mix as well.
Yeah, and, you know, when you talk about, I guess, Juventus managing a budget and budgetary issues, a lot of those relating back to the fact that they're paying an absolute ton to Ronaldo and a lot to players they signed for free, like Ramsey and Rabiot as well. What Conceição has done for a club that's been ailing financially is pretty remarkable. I mean, I do wonder if he will come up against Juventus in Serie A at some point in the future. Maybe, I guess, Lazio, one of his former clubs, would be one of the ones if Simone Inzaghi chose to move on. But it's remarkable that to think when he took this job over, and before this season, he's won the title 2 years out of three on like not much of a budget at all. You know, Marco Silva, before he came to Watford, was offered the Porto job. And they said, well, basically, your deal is you've got to win the title back from Benfica and we've got to sell 100 million euros worth of players. How does that sound? And he was like, you know what? I see my future as being in the Premier League. Whereas Conceição broke a big contract that he just signed with Nantes, partly for family reasons, but partly because Porto was something that spoke to him. And, you know, he took on a really tough job and he's made an amazing job of it, because I think still there's this cliche of Porto being these transfer market kings, which they're not anymore at all. If you look forward to next summer, they're going to lose another couple of big players for free. Otavio and Musa Marega, who scored the second goal, will both go for nothing. Marega will probably come to the Premier League, and there are clubs like Sevilla and Milan interested in Otavio. So he's had to make do and mend. And also, this story of his son coming into the team, Francisco, the middle one of his five sons, it's an extraordinary tale, because he played his first minutes for the Porto first team at 18 years old at the weekend. He came on against Boavista, and that they were losing. He helped them get back into the game, and he won a penalty after they come back from 2-0 down to get to 2-2. Which Sergio Oliveira, the captain, having already scored one penalty, then missed. Then Francisco Conceição got the ball again. And honestly, the talent is something. He's so slippery on the ball. There's a little bit of Paulo Futre about him, dare I say it. He set up what looked like a winner for Evan Nielsen. It was celebrated wildly. And it was one of those moments where the whole world around Conceição Senior and Junior stopped. It was father and son hugging each other, looking into each other's eyes, crying. It was a beautiful moment. And then, obviously, the goal was disallowed 5 minutes later by VAR, which is the most heartless, borderline application of VAR that I've seen. Of all the many VAR moments we've seen and complained about over the last while, it was one of the worst. But I kind of feel that this was their fairy tale ending, because against the team that Conceição Senior has had so many battles with in Serie A, his son comes on near the end, helps him tough it out, and makes his Champions League debut at 18.
Thanks. It's more like HAL and Space Odyssey rather than VAR. Just cruel.
Pessoal, Marinho, lá de Itareme, gol! Erro da Juve, Itareme! 1:10, Porto!
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Stakhanov's brand new show, My Seven Wonders, with Clive Anderson, is available to listen to now. Clive will be quizzing some of the world's most interesting celebrities, including Griff Rhys-Jones and Shappi Kosandi, about their own personal Seven Wonders of the World. Join Clive and his first guest, Dara O'Brien. Dara talks to Clive about his love for the Irish sport hurling and some of the extra benefits that come with owning a hurley stick.
It's just pleasant to have a big stick in the house every so often. For home security, it's always nice to know that I have an arsenal if I need it.
Oh, bear that in mind if I'm tempted to burgle your house in the middle of the night.
Just do it. Honestly, that's how I stand. I stand naked with my Irish testicles dangling, challenging people.
They discuss finding humour in quantum physics.
It's like saying, is the cat dead or not? Would somebody just open the box? Would somebody just open the box?
And discovering new passions during lockdown.
Lockdown ran a schism, essentially, between the young comics who immediately went, I must learn new skills. I must learn video editing and TikTok. And I must find new ways to bring back comedy to people. And the older comics went, yeah, retirement, it'd be all right, actually. Sit in the garden. Turns out, you know, it's okay.
It's not too bad.
Search My Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson on your favourite podcast player to hear the first episode now.
My Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stakhanov production.
in the Bundesliga, there's an impending changing of the guard. Certainly for Dortmund, they've got a new coach. This is announced mid-season. Marco Rosa is going there, but what about his current position at Mönchengladbach? Where does that leave him? Do you understand why they do this, Miguel? They announce the new coach in the middle of the season. Effectively, I would have thought, leaving the coach in his current job as a lame duck.
Well, it's happened a few times in European football, to be fair, and with players more so, the situation has often happened to Dortmund. So I suppose it maybe put a different twist the next time they suffer for it. But yeah, I mean, we have seen this, and I suppose it's different when there's an element of goodwill from the club and almost an appreciation for what you've done. And then it becomes a different kind of momentum about it, where it becomes about kind of, let's end this the right way rather than let it peter out. But of course, it does create, I mean, with the most classic example of all time being Ferguson's decision to announce his retirement for 2002, it can lead to a kind of a psychological slackening off, because players know the manager's not, it's subconscious, but it does happen. And there is a danger to it, but I suppose it's something that's impossible to avoid, ultimately, because news will leak out. So it's better that all the parties involved get a handle of it. That's why it happens, but it isn't necessarily always for the best.
That's it, isn't it? It's to stop that drip, drip, drip of speculation. And,
yeah.
I think the thing is, there's amicable ends to a business relationship, and there's just business-like ends to a business relationship. I think this kind of falls more towards the latter, really. I mean, the club haven't really criticised Marco Rosa, but Max Eberl, the sporting director, has said, well, look, I know people are criticising us for the clause, but, you know, if you want to criticise the situation, don't criticise Rosa, criticise me, because I put the clause in his contract, and if I didn't put the clause in his contract, he wouldn't have come to Borussia Mönchengladbach in the first place, which I think is right. I mean, as Miguel says, we've had this happen before many times, especially in German football, where, bear in mind, Julian Nagelsmann was announced as the next Leipzig coach a full year before he actually took the job on. I realize this is slightly different this time, because there's a direct rivalry to get a Champions League place now between Borussia Mönchengladbach and Borussia Dortmund. So you're sort of fighting to keep your integrity in the present while closing your eyes and not worrying too much about the future. Because if he's kind of backing a project that could completely change what he goes into at Dortmund, if they don't arrive in the Champions League, as we said last week, Dotton, not only does Sancho have to go, but maybe they have to sell a Reina, a Rafael Guerrero, maybe even, God forbid, an Erling Haaland. So in terms of the team that he'll have around him next season, whether they make the Champions League or not, this will have a massive effect. Of course, after that win in Sevilla in the last 16, mainly authored by Haaland, maybe they'll win the thing, and maybe that's their way of getting there. I don't know. Stranger things have happened in the Champions League over the last while. But they feel happy that they've got Rosa. There's no doubt about that. Because, especially in recent weeks, there's been this feeling of not only... They knew that Edin Terzic, the current incumbent, the former assistant to Lucien Favre, wasn't going to be the long-term solution. He wasn't going to be their Hansi Flick. But there's just been that lack of leadership on and off the pitch, and that feeling of, we need this alpha with a strong philosophy who can really lead us forward. And of course, the idea that Dortmund have kind of mourned since Klopp, this lack of, you know, a real snarling, jumping up and down on the touchline, crash bang wallop kind of football sort of leader, which is what they feel that Marco Rosa could do. And of course, Marco Rosa played for Klopp at Mainz, and he's very much Klopp endorsed, and I think that counts for a lot.
I suppose the good news, Miguel, for Mönchengladbach fans is that Rosa, being a gentleman, has promised not to nick any of their players and take them with him to Dortmund, which is great. But just in case he stops being a gentleman, which of the players at Mönchengladbach would he take with him to Dortmund? Just in case.
Well, I mean, that's another situation we've seen many times in the past as well. And let's not forget, it's not usually the managers that make the decisions anymore. It's sporting directors above their head. So that's kind of almost a little bit of an empty call. I suppose, I mean, the big one, especially given this Champions League season, is Thuram. It's going to be fascinating to see how that plays out. I suppose Dortmund Dortmund aren't quite Bayern in that way. They're not, I mean, even though as these things go, it tends to be trickle down and everyone's always coming in the next step, but they're not quite as, they haven't been quite as ruthless in terms of always taking the players or hobbling the teams from just below them.
I don't think they're above nicking other kids' lunch money, to be perfectly honest. I think everyone assumes that it's all Bayern. I agree with you, because they're the biggest and the best, and they have been for so long. But I'll never forget Jurgen Klopp saying when, of course, the ultimate in pre-announced transfers was when the Mario Götze to Bayern story leaked.
Yeah.
Just 2 days before day and a half before the semi-final in the Champions League against Real Madrid. And Klopp was very sanguine about it. They're victims, if you like, of a pre-arranged buyout clause in the contract. And he said, look, we did exactly the same to Borussia Mönchengladbach to buy Marco Reus off them. So, you know, it is just swings and roundabouts. And, you know, Dortmund have used clauses since to bring in other players. You know, it's just one of those things. But I do think Rosa has taken a little bit of a risk, because if they don't make Champions League, it is a completely different job to the one that he's going to be doing otherwise. I was impressed, though, that Edin Terzic, and I'm pleased for him, actually, because he comes across as a good guy who's putting a good effort and is really just not had the requisite authority with a team a squad that's more pig-headed than you would think. They've managed to produce good bits of football, really good bits of football in 2021, but only in really 10-15 minute spells. I think the thing that impressed me against Sevilla is, like, in the second half they defended, and for the bulk of it they defended pretty well. So I don't think you can quite talk about it as a turning point yet, but I don't know, if I was of a Dortmund persuasion, what would give me hope is that the players do seem invested in it. And I think the fact that they know Rosa is going to be there at the end of the season, for someone like Haaland, for example, this is absolutely huge. And say, as we're going back to the beginning, if someone doesn't have the money to buy him, which I think is quite possible, he needs to be convinced that he can stay at Dortmund the extra year. And knowing Rosa is coming and knowing that the club has a plan is big for that, I think.
Yeah. As well as that, I do wonder, I mean, I wrote a piece in this last week, or actually started this week, for the kind of the resumption of the Champions League. But with the congested schedule and the kind of, there are, as with some domestic leagues, we are going to see a few distortions we wouldn't usually get. And I wonder whether we'll see a situation similar to the start of the expanded Champions League between 2000 and 2007, where clubs are actually still, they're adjusting to kind of the European schedule. They're not used to having so many games, or in this case, so many games in such quick succession. And what it meant at the turn of the millennium for about 8 years was that clubs that were having indifferent or sorry, poor domestic seasons suddenly raised it in Europe. It might have been a psychological component, maybe it was just because it was an opportunity to get reform. But a lot of those champions from Milan to Liverpool to Real Madrid finished kind of fourth and fifth. And I wonder if we'll be in a situation here just across the board, whether it's just one of those strange seasons where teams that are having poor domestic campaigns just see an opportunity in Europe. And Dortmund could be a case of that as well. Because, I mean, the there was such a drastic difference between their performance against Sevilla and what they did at the weekend.
It's fascinating when we're talking about German coaches. That always seems, they seem to be very much an important factor in the success of teams nowadays. I know every generation has its sort of regional coaches, Italian coaches or Dutch coaches, etc. It does seem to be like we're in the era of the German coach now, Andy, that, you know, look at what Tuchel has done at Chelsea, for example, has turned their fortunes around. What's going on? What do these German coaches have in approach to the game or the style that they get their teams to play out? Why are they the popular choice for amongst coaches in Europe at the moment?
Well, I think it all goes back to Euro 2000 and the aftermath of that. The fact that that was a kind of a year zero for German player development. And I think this has a huge knock-on effect for coaching. There was a definite impetus put on the Bundesliga teams in a way that could never happen in England because the Premier League clubs have too much power to just back their academies and put a lot more in and start creating a different type of football, really, and a different type of footballer. And that's something that led to the 2006 World Cup, later led on to various finals, and then the win in 2014 in Brazil. So I think coaching and the development of players is a discussion that has completely changed in the 21st century in Germany. Mm. Now, I guess another thought we've had out of the Champions League this week, Miguel, is what next for Julian Nagelsmann? Because I don't know about you, but I felt quite strongly the way in which I went out of the Champions League last season, and of course they did brilliantly to get to the semi-final against Paris Saint-Germain, suggested that there's very much a ceiling here. And I had that feeling again against Liverpool, where they weren't terrible, but they were undermined by a few big mistakes at key moments, which are kind of a legacy of generally of having young players, although obviously the mistake for the first goal was made by a quite experienced player in Marcel Sabitzer. I wonder when Nagelsmann decides to move on, because he is intensely ambitious, where does he end up? To me, I think the Premier League seems quite a clear option.
Yeah, completely. In fact, there's been indications he's already looking in that direction. And just as regards Leipzig this season, I mean, the proof of recent football history is kind of financial disparities escalated and teams have been stripped apart more quickly. I mean, just as a classic example of that, if you look at the Partizan Belgrade team that got to the final in 1967 as a kind of a modern, as an equivalent at the time of a surprise team doing well. I remember doing a piece on this, and I think it took them 6 or 7 years to be stripped apart, or like say the 700 players to go. Now, obviously, there were other reasons because of kind of, you know, Yugoslavia was a communist state at the time, all the rest of it. Whereas nowadays, a team that does well on a given season, they often lose the majority of their players within a year. And the recent proof of it, of football, is no matter how well a club is run, no matter how good the model, performance levels just can't be sustained if you keep losing big players. And again, Dortmund are a classic example of that, as are Tottenham Hotspur, who are one club who've been seriously looking at Nagelsmann. I mean, I've already heard in the last few weeks that if Spurs were to get rid of Mourinho, which is something I don't think that will happen, at least until the end of the season, Nagelsmann is on the list. But I think Nagelsmann has almost outgrown Spurs at the moment, and I think he'd be looking much higher. Chelsea were interested in before they went to Tuchel, from what I've heard, because they because they realised Nagelsmann wasn't available, and I think he'd be looking at maybe a top job in England, one of the real big four.
It's the point where we ask you to select a game of the week for us to enjoy. Do you have one, Andy, first?
Yeah, I think there are some really good ones this weekend, and I'm really keen to see how Bayern Munich get on at Eintracht Frankfurt, who are absolutely on fire at the moment on Saturday afternoon. However, there can only be one, and it has to be the Milan derby on Sunday afternoon. Of course, Inter have just finally taken over at the top from Milan after Milan surprisingly lost to Spezia, which Nicky wrote about so brilliantly in the Guardian this week.
I know.
It feels like Inter have got this moment that they have to seize. And if they can at least get a result that keeps them top of the table, that will be the next little test for them. But I don't know. I feel that Milan have still got a little bit in the tank. This is where we see whether Inter have got the sang-froid to close out the title, I think.
Miguel, so you've got the Milan derby to compete with. Can you match that?
Well, since Andy took that one off me, I'm going to go for Paris Saint-Germain and Monaco. As much because of the situation at the table, of course, as all the hype around Mbappe this week, especially given this is his old club and some of the subplots we've mentioned in this very show. And of course, because, I mean, there is, let's not forget, as good as Paris Saint-Germain looked in Europe, there is, at the moment, that bit of pressure on them in France. And, I mean, for Pochettino, or for this team, not to win the league this season would be huge. I still suspect they'll eventually tear away, but they need to win a game like this to do so. And so there's a bit there.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit. And he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, mate.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking out?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.